talk about a couple of potential observations that are different from the CMB that I think would be particularly useful for constraining scale dependence. So this is work done with Marilena Loverde, Amber Miller, and Licia Verde. And Mari is the grad student who's responsible for most of the plots that you're going to see. And it should appear next week, hopefully. So first, let me tell you what I think is sort of the big issue driving this work. And it's probably one you're all familiar with, which is just the idea of, is there a useful discriminating feature of inflationary models? So by that I mean, you know, you can write down lots of the slow roll potentials that sort of reproduce the few numbers that we can get out of the CMB. But it'd be great if we had some sort of a feature that can really distinguish between those models and maybe give us more of a handle on what the fundamental inflaton really is. And I think a couple of ideas that might do that have been suggested recently by string theory, just by the fact that we're trying to actually find any kind of a successful inflationary model in string theory. And the ones that have been semi-successful do have some interesting and unusual features. And then if you want to be really optimistic as sort of a string theorist, you might hope that those features are going to be sort of distinctive signs of string theory in the sense that you can imagine them arising from maybe field theory, but sort of they naturally live in string theory models. So I think non-Gaussianity is an excellent example of something that does all of this. It does allow us to distinguish between models that look the same at the level of the power spectrum. It is suggested from string theory, and it's sort of unusual in the sense that you might not expect to write down this form of non-Gaussianity if you were just inventing inflationary models. So to support that, I first want to tell you, again, remind you why non-Gaussianity is such a good discriminator between models, and tell you sort of a more general theoretical description of models that are non-Gaussian than is typically used. I want to motivate for you scale dependence. You can say scale dependent, why not, basically. But you can also take specific examples of inflation in string theory or sort of general phenomenological examples of inflation where scale dependence is very natural and where the interpretation of it has a pretty cool relationship to the geometry of the extra dimension. So if you want to go crazy with string theory, you're learning something very interesting about the underlying theory by looking at scale dependence. And then the two observations that I want to consider are, first of all, counting galaxy clusters, which is sensitive to the distribution of density fluctuations, particularly on the tail, which is where the non-Gaussianity shows up. And then, if I get a chance, also what you can say about the bispectrum. OK, so first of all, why and what is non-Gaussianity? So again, just the motivation that the numbers that we have so far, typically, you know, you can describe for the most part an inflationary model in terms of some potential of the inflaton field phi and its derivative, so sort of standard procedure at some scale, which is, you know, relevant for the CMB. And there's been a lot of work sort of reconstructing the potential from the data that we have that many people have worked on, including Will. And I think it's fair to say that the upshot of all of that is that we really don't get a unique answer. We don't learn too much about what the fundamental theory should be just from these numbers. So you can go beyond the power spectrum, and it's definitely clear that the three-point function, any higher order function, correlation function, has more information. So to sort of demonstrate this, we can just take the typical ansatz for non-Gaussianity, which is usually used, where you take, for example, the primordial curvature in space, and you allow that to be some function that has a sort of a standard Gaussian piece, and then just a nonlinear piece with some coefficient FNL, like the square of that field. So if you take the Fourier transform of that, and you require that FNL is small enough, basically FNL times zeta, or the square root of the variance, is small enough, then you can do all of your usual calculations of the two-point function, and none of that changes. So none of your observables from the previous page change. They don't care. But when you write down the three-point function, it has a coefficient that's proportional to FNL, first of all. And then it has an interesting dependence on the momenta. So the power spectrum, obviously, is just a function of k. The three-point function depends on these triangles, which are the momenta summed up in some way. So for this FNL model, this local model, there's a very particular function of k that comes in here that you can test. What is that doing physically? Well, if you just look at what happens to the distribution, so this is, for example, the probability distribution for the density fluctuations or the gravitational potential or whatever you want to take it to be. If you take sort of reasonable, you know, values of these parameters just for illustration, and you allow FNL to be positive or negative, if you take a positive skewness, you just lift this tail over here. You lift the high fluctuation, positive fluctuation tail, and a negative skewness suppresses it. So basically, if you translate between the curvature perturbation to the density perturbation, if you have a positive skewness, so you have a higher probability of these large several sigma fluctuations, you have more structures. So for example, more clusters, more galaxy clusters. On the other, you know, obviously if you suppress it, if you make negative skewness, then you expect fewer clusters. And there's sort of interesting correlations about how the rest of this distribution moves that you can hope to probe through something like the bispectrum that really sees a whole range of k values, not just this high tail here. But in general, we don't have something that looks quite like this FNL. So this one is written down sort of in a phenomenological sense that's useful if you want to analyze data or you want some sort of ansatz for FNL. But usually if we're talking about a fundamental inflationary model, what we have instead is actually, you know, some action, some Lagrangian for the inflaton field. And a useful form of that in the context of non-Gaussianity is this formalism written down by Mukhanov and collaborators, which is this general sound speed formalism, where you take the Lagrangian for the inflaton to be not just a function of the inflaton, but also of this parameter x, which is basically like phi dot squared. So, of course, the standard theory has phi dot squared and some potential, and then the parameter, the sound speed, which parameterizes how different this model is from sort of standard slow roll, just is one here. But if you start adding in more powers of phi dot squared, you get some term here that comes in, and the sound speed is less than one. So the sound speed shows up in many places in your observations, sort of telling you how different you are from standard theory. But you can go through the rest of the calculations of the cosmology in a pretty straightforward way.
So the skewness, the sign of skewness, so if I have a positive FNL, it means more clusters, but fewer voids, so to speak, is that
how? Yeah, fewer small. I mean, I'm not sure when you...
On the
voids is an interesting question, yeah. So...
I'm just looking, because yeah. Positive skewness pushes the area on the positive side of delta rho.
Perhaps I thought that positive skewness was more clustering.
That's right, but see, if
yeah, that's why I'm confused, that's why I'm asking.
Right, so to conserve the area, right, you have to conserve probability, basically. If you tilt the distribution, then it does move, and so overall, you do end up with fewer, let's see, so if you lift this tail, you have more small points.
You could have more clusters and fewer points, but if you just drew the x distance here uniformly, you can... Yeah, well, I guess it would depend on more voids.
Yeah.
I mean, do you have more empty...
And voids are a little tricky, right, because you can only go to zero empty space versus you can go to more and more and more over-dense regions. So it depends a little bit on exactly how large this number is, how much area there is you're pushing in this close-to empty region.
What is the horizontal axis in this plot?
So in this case, you can just think of it as sigma fluctuations, one sigma fluctuation, two sigma
fluctuations. Oh, okay. The curve like this for every scale.
The principle can be scaled, it can be scaled. This is just FNL, so it can't be scaled in this case, but for more general distribution, it could be. So voids are interesting if we want to. Okay. So if you want to write down the analog of the three-point function for this model, that's been worked out by extended collaborators. And in general, it's a complicated expression. Basically, you could pull out sort of this fact that it depends on basically two powers of the power spectrum. But then you have a bunch of different terms here that have k dependence. So to simplify things, I'm going to say that I'm going to ignore most of these terms. A lot of them are actually lower order. So these terms are enhanced by the sound speed. And these are sort of your standard terms that are proportional to slow roll parameters. And then you have some that have both factors of sound speed and slow roll parameters. So I'm going to ignore all of the terms that are effectively lower order. And this term, in the example of BVI, is also effectively lower order. So I'm just going to concentrate on one term here, which kind of captures the features of the model. In here? So
if you were to go into the structures, how many three parameters do you completely have?
So basically, you could say, well, in principle, I have lots of three parameters in front of the terms of the Lagrangian.
Right, how many matter in that three-point function?
So the terms, basically, the sound speed matters only. So the sound speed, you know, is some function of all of those terms that you added. Mm-hmm. And the sound speed plus the usual slow roll parameters matter. So then those are the parameters of your potential.
So this has just the usual sort of epsilon eta vectors, and then determinant for the change to the distance B. So in a sense, you could say free, but those are built up of loss of three.
Why are you using this model?
So this model in general is. So two reasons. One, it's relatively general, right? It includes some higher order derivatives, and it doesn't include all possible higher derivatives.
It's sort of unstable.
Sort of unstable. Well, if you limit yourself to some speed, you know, less than one, things like that, I think it'd be reasonable, right? Mm-hmm. If you limit to, for example, some speed less than one, not some speed greater than one, okay, it'd be reasonable.
What's the instability you're talking about?
Well, because it's a nonlinear, the kinetic energy is weird, right?
So, oh, the other thing I should say is...
A red flag goes up.
Right. The other thing I should say is I'm only dealing with models of potential energy nonlinear here. So I'm going to stay out of most of the weird
assumptions.
Well, also, it comes up with Rayleigh models as an effect theory. And Rayleigh models as an effect theory. Right, so that there's regions where you have effective theory for most of this, but the underlying fundamental theory is...
It's perfectly stable theory.
Yeah.
Yeah, but...
I think for the case of, for example, TBI, it's okay. So I think, as an example, I can
trust it there. What happens if you use a normal kinetic energy?
You don't get a large non-gas energy.
You don't what?
Get a large non-gas energy. So then you aren't likely to be stable in the first place. What's that?
Harmonic effect is that.
So if it's slow roll, then your non-gas energy is proportional to your slow roll parameters, your spectral energy, basically. And there's no way to avoid that without adding terms, basically, that don't explode. So it's only by adding sort of kinetic terms can you get larger gas energy but still have enough inflation.
For single field,
and for something that's smooth, because if you start adding those steps, you're definitely but I think all of those cases are also scale dependent, because especially if you add a particular step, that's a feature of a particular scale. So I think even though the equations that I'm going to show you can follow for that case, you know, the sort of idea that we should be searching for scale dependence. Okay. So here's what this particular term looks like. And I just want to show it to you for two reasons. One, to indicate that the dependence on k is very different, obviously, than the various momentum vectors. And you've probably heard the big distinguishing feature between this and the local model is that this is largest for equilateral triangle configurations, whereas the local model is largest in sort of squeeze limit where you have two momentum much larger than the other. So
there's a very different shape to these functions that you can in principle test and that are very distinguishing between the two models. The other feature is just that the coefficient here grows as the sound speed shrinks. And this is essentially controlling the size of that non-Gaussianity. So if you have a small sound speed, you have a large non-Gaussianity. And that's the feature we're interested in. You can take a shape that looks sort of like this and redo the CMB analysis for scale-independent case. And that's been done by Criminelli. And they basically do that by defining a sort of effective FNL at the scale where all momenta are equal, which is maybe not the best way of parameterizing this, but that's what they've done. And in that case, you find some bounds on the effective FNL, which is different from the local model, which you expect, again, because the shape is different. So these bounds are essentially what we'll be using to pin down the restrictions on the non-Gaussianity at CMB scales, and then let it change from there. Okay, so this sort of is a discussion we just had, but just as a reminder, how non-Gaussian are we expecting this to be? In the slow roll case, for the squeeze limit, Malvasina showed that, again, FNL is very small, probably unobservably small, if you take, you know, FNL 5, roughly, of observable by the CMB, for example, with Planck. Criminelli went through an analysis where he basically said, okay, I don't want to ruin slow roll, so let me just add a few terms that are, you know, basically like this x squared, phi dot to the fourth, some terms like that, and see how large of FNL I expect. And his analysis says, basically, if you start doing this in a controlled expansion of field theory, you expect FNL of order 1. So much, much larger than the slow roll case, but still not huge, nowhere near the current observational limits. The interesting thing about something like DBI is that you can actually get saturation of the current CMB bounds. FNL you know, of order 100, like we saw on the last page. And this is a surprisingly large answer, and basically happens because, as I'll show you in a minute, you have this square root in DBI, which is summing for you many, 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 you know, basically an infinite sum of terms of powers of that x of phi dot for you. So because you have a square root in a limit where it can't be expanded, you're getting a surprisingly large answer. And you see similar effects in other actions that also have these sort of sum forms. Okay, so what about the scale dependence? This is just motivating for you why large non-Gaussianity is interesting. But where does scale dependence come in? So the first obvious answer is why not? Most of the cosmological functions that we look at can be scale dependent. And in fact, even in the slow roll case, where it's proportional to the scalar index, spectral index, of course it is somewhat scale dependent. So there's no reason for this not to be. And as I'll show you, the well-motivated cases with large non-Gaussianity, so where we might actually hope to observe this scale dependence, do have scale-dependent forms, which is interesting. And that's great, because if it is scale-dependent, you have lots of interesting correlations with other observables. For example, the tensor-scalar ratio. And that gives you a lot of handles on whether your model is consistent through a range of scales.
For small non-Gaussianity too, right? Like wants, for example.
Exactly.
And that's not responding to the scale, the spectrum runs.
Exactly. So I think overall you have, you know, because you have a natural inflation starts and ends, that already gives you sort of a natural scale dependence right
here. Well, that takes the scale dependence to be so dominant though, right? I mean,
Yeah,
it's small.
Yeah. So if you like, you know, solar parameters for three after or something like that, but yeah.
Okay, so here's an example you're probably familiar with, but let me just remind you of the important features, which is DBI brain inflation. So this is sort of a much simplified form of the DBI action with some potential, all of that. And the key feature, again, is just that you have this square root, which has phi dot squared in it, and some function t. And that function t is phi dependent. So in this case, phi, the inflaton, is the position of the brain going into a warp throat, and the warp factor depends on the position in that throat. So automatically, you have this speed limit that depends on your position, basically. And that speed limit is allowing you to have a steep potential while still getting enough inflation, because your field doesn't roll quickly. And the typical way to sort of parameterize how close you are to that speed limit is with this gamma of phi, which is typical Lorentz factor, basically. And in DBI, it turns out that gamma of phi is exactly 1 over the sound speed. So everywhere the gamma shows up, that's effectively the sound speed showing up. And the non-Gaussianity then goes basically like gamma squared with some factor. Yeah.
So I think this is probably what you had in mind. So when you write down the DBI action, it's valid for it's just a small derivative approximation.
Sure.
So there are high derivative functions there. And so the original probability of the DBI implies that the gamma is actually very close to 1.
No, you can check that the higher derivatives, like the acceleration, proper acceleration, is small, even if gamma is large.
How do you check that? I'm saying that there could be phi double dot terms in the, you know, in your DBI actions that I don't think anybody computed in general.
That's right. So in Eva Silverstein's original paper on this,
she
does check the proper acceleration of the brain is small, even the large. Because basically this is a local speed limit, right?
No, I'm just saying that the DBI is valid when phi dot squared over t is much less than 1.
So, no, phi dot squared over t, sorry, can be large, you just can't have large acceleration, right? You can be close to 1, but you can't have large acceleration.
Phi dot squared.
Yeah. Right, it's the higher
Yeah, sorry, you're right. I'm sorry, yes.
Yeah. So you're right, in general, there are certainly corrections that you should check. And I think the interesting point, though, also, is that even if you do have, for example, you need to include those corrections, I don't think you're spoiled with this sort of effect that you have lots and lots of higher derivative terms coming in. And basically, it's the fact that you have lots and lots of higher derivative terms that's giving you a large non-Gaussianity. So I would expect that even if you are in a situation where you need those corrections, you probably still have an interesting signal.
What
are the
C-suggestions?
It's taken as a ratio, the speed of light with speed of light equal to 1.
Mm-hmm.
It's taken as a ratio to the speed of light with speed of light equal to 1.
Okay.
So that's it. Yeah, and maybe, I guess, one of the most interesting correlations between observables here is with the tensor-scalar ratio. Because basically, the typical sort of slow roll expression is this, something like DBI has a 1 over gamma, so if you're seeing a large non-Gaussianity, you expect basically a suppressed tensor scalar ratio, or you expect if you have increasing non-Gaussianity, you have decreasing tensor scalar. So that's one of those things you can sort of check to see if you have consistency for a model like this. Okay. So let me just remind you, because it pops up in the next slides, what are the useful parameters for this model? So because it can have a steep potential, I'm not using the typical slow roll parameters. Instead, I'm going to talk about the Hubble parameter instead of the potential. And it turns out your sort of standard parameters are just modified by a factor of gamma here. So again, that's a way of saying that if the potential is steep, you still get controlled sort of slow roll if gamma is large. So. The third parameter here that pops in, I'm going to call kappa. And you can see that kappa measures essentially a change in gamma, which is measuring a change in the sound speed. So it's kappa that I'm going to use to parameterize the scale dependence of this model. And that happens like this. For DBI, this is the expression that comes out. Basically, the sound speed goes as the sound speed at some pivot scale with the ratio of scales to the kappa. Again, this is just writing that coefficient for the case of the equilateral limit. And I'm going to use this as sort of to make a new sort of ansatz for scale-dependent non-Gaussianity. So I'm going to say, well, converting this to FNL, I'm going to take FNL at an effective FNL at some scale to be equal to an FNL that I measure, for example, at CMB scales with the ratio of those scales to the minus 2 kappa. Yeah?
The potential tilt doesn't depend on epsilon, epsilon, eta, and kappa.
Yeah,
so kappa could be at most a percent or something like that.
So kappa, okay, so kappa, as I've written it, is a slow roll parameter, essentially. But there's no reason for it actually to be small, except that I would need to go back to kappa.
I'm going to have cancer patients too, should have been a cap for the big thing.
Right,
but it's hard to maintain that versus the evil. You'd have maybe. So, I mean, the argument for why epsilon and eta are percent is because, unless there's some miraculous fine tuning, then that's.
So I'll stick to the case where this is less than 1. It's sort of these numbers I naturally popped up in the EF equation. I think certainly models, again, where you have like a step where you go back and fix all the numerical, they could have cap at least temporarily large. So you can have this temporarily large step.
Okay. Besides, you're going to have a lot of inflation of the speed of sound, essentially, if you're slow linearing.
Right.
And so, in fact, the derivation done by Chen and I wrote down the formula of the three as soon as you have a slow linearing, which basically slowly
very much
basically
must
this kappa less than
1. And it's also a self-consistent condition for using a DBR, because a large scale dependence implies a large within by large acceleration.
Potentially, yeah. Okay. So the cool thing about this in DBI is just that this scale dependence of kappa is tracking the warp factor. So if you use the ADS throat versus you use Klebanov-Strassler exact solution versus you use whatever sort of warp factor you're interested in, you get a different scale dependence. So this is just sort of comparing the various warp factors in the tau coordinate that's natural for Klebanov-Strassler at the bottom of the throat. But the only thing I want to point out primarily is that in the ADS case, which it's hard to see here because it's logarithmic, but in the ADS case, the sound speed basically blows up to infinity. There's nothing to cut it off. Your scale factor or your warp factor is just, you know, r to the 4 over your position to the 4. So as that position goes to 0, you blow up to infinity. In the full Klebanov-Strassler solution or some approximations to that, you round off the throat. So your warp factor naturally goes to a constant at the bottom, which means that gamma naturally goes to a constant. In other words, your sound speed naturally goes to a constant. So there's a very interesting feature where everything is sort of nicely behaved in the full solution here. And if you're experimenting with various warp factors, it's interesting to see what happens to the non-Gaussianity. It's more about that, but maybe I'll just go on to the main point for the rest of the talk, which is that if I then just sort of plot what's allowed based on current constraints and what are the relevant observations, here's the region excluded by the CMB. I'm going to pretend that the current bound from the CMB applies basically at the smallest scale. Probably if the analysis were redone, maybe that's not true, but let's just pretend that it applies right there. And then we can allow kappa to take various values, maybe up to 0.3, which is probably pushing the range of validity, but maybe not too much. And you can see that the non-Gaussianity then, which is reasonable on CMB scales, can grow to something like 1,000 on scales relevant, for example, for clusters. So that's a big difference. And overall, then, if your clusters or your bispectrum is sensitive to non-Gaussianity at roughly the same level at the CMB, or even a little bit worse, you still can get constraints on how much the non-Gaussianity runs with scale based on that. So bispectrum probably lives somewhere in here, and clusters, because that's really pushing the limit of where the structure is nonlinear, is probably the smallest scale where you can hope to probe. Okay, so how do you actually test this with clusters? Okay, well, it's a little bit of a chore. What we want to do is basically count clusters. So we want to probe that very small tail of the distribution. So we want some number density of clusters as a function of their mass and their redshift. So first we have to take the primordial thing that we calculated. So we calculated inflaton non-Gaussianity, right? Put that in as curvature non-Gaussianity. We want to take that into matter today, essentially. So in order to get delta, we need to take the curvature perturbation, use the transfer function to carry the perturbation through, you know, horizon entry, matter radiation equality, and include how the perturbation grows as a function of scale, basically. So the other thing we need then is a probability distribution. So I showed you sort of a distribution for FNL that looked a little tilted one way or the other based on FNL. It's trickier when you don't have something straightforward like FNL and you just have your fundamental theory. So we need some way to write down a probability distribution. And then we need to use that distribution for delta and decide how objects collapse and then count them. Okay, so there's lots of complaints you can have with this. I'm sure you'll tell me some of them, but the basic thing that you can do is take some sort of a press sector approach and say, well, I'm interested in the fraction of stuff, the fraction of matter in some volume that has collapsed into objects. So to do that, take some model of collapse, like spherical collapse, which gives you some critical, you know, fluctuation size above which things actually collapse, and integrate how much of your probability distribution lives in that range. Once you have that fraction, you can use the density of the universe to convert essentially to objects of a mass around mass M, basically by converting with the density, taking some derivatives. And then you can say, well, actually, press sector never worked anyway, so let me use something that works a little better that's calibrated on simulations, and just use press sector as a way of seeing how much deviation from Gaussianity I have. So that's the approach we're going to take. We're going to figure out what probability distribution should be plugged in here. Use press sector to calculate the ratio of the non-Gaussian answer to the Gaussian answer, and then multiply it by a mass function from simulation that we think is a little more reasonable in terms of actually counting numbers of clusters. No one's going to bother me. Okay, so the worst part of all this is that we need a probability distribution. And that's tricky, right? If you have FNL, you can make some sort of like formal change of variable. You can get the whole distribution with all of the cumulants. If all you've done is go through the hard work of calculating the three-point function and you don't want to calculate anymore, what can you do? So let me just remind you sort of, you know, a general formalism of what we're doing here. Basically, you can characterize a distribution like a Gaussian by its mean and its variance. If you go beyond that, so we're looking at connected parts of higher order correlation functions. Those are the higher cumulants. And sort of a natural way of scaling them is to take out their dependence on the two-point, on the variance, basically. And you can see, for example, something like FNL, that's reasonable because we're left with just a constant here for this thing I'm going to call the skewness, instead of something that's also scale-dependent, basically. So in all those equations I had for the three-point function, we sort of pulled out factors of the power spectrum, and that takes out a lot of the scale dependence. For the Gaussian case, these are all equal to zero, so you know that. You just have these two to worry about. Then given a general model, we can hope to calculate something like the skewness, the kurtosis, and try to plug those back in. And there's a formal way to do that, to build back up the distribution. And basically, it just involves taking some Fourier transforms and things like that until you can put your cumulants into a sum here, put that in the exponential, and then integrate over this thing. You can see sort of the remnants of a Fourier transform in here. And the other thing we have to do to apply this to actual structure is smooth these cumulants on some scale R. So in other words, when we're talking about structure on some scale, we're interested in the fluctuations, you know, sort of averaged over that scale. So we don't care about little wiggles inside there. We just want overall, do I have a cluster or not? So we need to smooth also. So this is fine in some scenarios. And people often have done something called the Edgeworth expansion, which is just some further steps of that integral that I showed you, which is valid in some certain regime. And it's kind of nice to look at because it makes sense. You have something that looks like a Gaussian, and then you just add up corrections due to the various higher order cumulants. And those corrections are just multiplied with some functions. New here is delta over the variance, so the density fluctuation over the variance. So the problem with this is that it's only valid in a certain regime. Obviously, this is an expansion. So certainly, one thing that we're doing is ignoring the higher corrections. Okay, we're assuming that we can basically truncate this expansion here, for example, which means that this term is smaller than this term, certainly. And you can also see that it's an expansion in this mu, delta over sigma. So when that thing grows, this expansion is also not valid. So there are a lot of reasons not to be particularly happy with this approach. I think I'm going to show you that it works reasonably well up to the point where you can start to make predictions. But what you would really like are something like simulations to check, you know, at what point this breaks down, in what way it breaks down, things like that. It does it the next term. Yeah, I should change that to H6.
I'm confused. Why are you doing this? Why don't you just look at the data and compute the three-point function?
I want to predict it, right, from something like BVI. So I've only calculated the three-point function. I want to say, this is my non-Gaussian model. How many clusters do I expect versus how many do I see?
Oh, awesome. Observational. You're saying there's no... The three-point function fundamental is not directly encoded at the cluster density. You need to go through this whole probability distribution function to understand the collapse well enough to get any useful measure out.
The other approach that probably should be done is to start, is to simulate starting with this non-Gaussian distribution and move forward. But if it's not FNL type, you basically run into all these same difficulties in preparing for yourself, your fake data of your initial fluctuations. So these problems seem to crop up in a similar way no matter which approach you take, but they're particularly bad here.
Is there some way in which the non-Gaussian interval three-point function is a dominant one compared to high-point correlation functions?
Yes, and that's part of the crucial assumption that we're making here, right, to do this expansion. And if you look, for example, anything that's going to look roughly Gaussian at CMB scales should have this feature, that the higher-order correlation function should be less significant. Certainly something like FNL does, right? Because at each stage you're multiplying by more and more powers of the variance, which is less than one. So that's true in a lot of reasonable cases. What's less clear is when you have scale dependence, at what scales that remains true. And again, I would expect that anything that looks sort of like a Gaussian, it can be smoothly taken to a Gaussian, has that feature, but you need to check.
How about in the BI case? Did people make a case that...
The other thing that's been computed is the tri-spec, basically, the full one. And there you can check that it seems reasonable that it satisfies this type of criteria, at least at CMB scales. But again, what happens is, as the kitchen room scale is something that needs to be looked at.
No, I have a question. Because you put a higher order correlation function, you need more accurate fits to do the job. And you get to 3.4 value loss because there's a limit to how accurate the data can move.
Right. So
and it causes me variance in those.
Right. So as you move to smaller scales, you have more and more points, basically, or you have more and more depth points to work with. More and more problems, if you like. So part of the utility of using the galaxy bistructure at smaller scales is your signal to noise can grow and wins out. So I think. Not just the idea of the level that I'm going to talk about here is definitely observable in the bispectrum. And there's some indication that even maybe the full point is observable.
If you see something, it's true.
Yes.
Still.
Yes. Otherwise, yes. Okay, so there are lots of issues here. And just to illustrate some of the things that can go wrong, if you truncate this expansion, you can end up with little negative regions in your probability distribution, which doesn't look too good, but can be corrected by including more and more. So really, you want to do the best that you can here in the hope that you avoid little issues like that. let me just show you some of the results. Okay, so this is the mass function again. So this is the number of clusters. So this is going through that whole procedure, taking something like DBI, you know, with just one term, calculating the skewness, putting into the probability distribution, and working out what is the number density of clusters as a function of mass. And again, this is the ratio of the non-Gaussian answer to the Gaussian answer, where we've used that data from simulations to sort of correct the mass function. So this is going to be different at different redshifts, which I'm showing here. Before I tell you what the curves are, the shaded regions are regions where we're expecting that distribution to break down. So that's happening at higher masses, because higher masses require larger fluctuations. And as you go to larger and larger Z, you need even a larger fluctuation to have created a cluster of the same mass. So these regions are where we don't trust the answer based on that expansion. Okay. Given that, though, I think you'll agree that basically for many of these curves, we're seeing a 20 to 30% shift in the answer, which is pretty big. So now what are the curves? So these are pinning, again, FNL at CMV scales, either the positive limit or the negative limit, and taking various values of kappa. So the curves in pink and in blue are the model that was explicitly checked against the CMV by Criminelli. So this is this sort of easily comparable to data, factorizable form of the three-point function, if you're familiar with that. And this is actually that term that I showed you, that AC term that's the answer for DBI. So these are a little bit different, but not too much. So you can see positive skewness gives you more clusters. Negative skewness gives you less clusters, actually, which you would expect. And something like kappa of minus 0.3 is giving you a huge deviation. Now, again, you might argue that that's sort of borderline of where you need to worry about other terms, but you're getting maybe a 40%.
But to understand why we're getting negative skewness here in the median.
Yeah. Okay, this is a great question, and one I really wish I knew the answer to. Trying hard. And it's really disappointing because there was some confusion about the sign, right? And then in Maldacena's like squeeze limit, you can understand the sign. For general DBI, I really don't know, and I would love to know if it's related to, you know, any model with sound speed less than one.
Should have negative skewness? I don't know. But I would love to know. Well, I mean, the general sound speed case, right, the case of Chin, has many terms which cover the general case. Mm-hmm. So you can look at those individual terms and look at conditions for the sign to change. For something like, let's see, I think ghost inflation, it changes sign, but ghost inflation, you like it, I don't know. So
that seems to be the first framework is always negative.
I think it's not totally clear what general reasonable conditions would change something.
No,
I would love to know.
Getting back to Justin's question, is there some other wide distribution function that you could maybe also?
Yeah, I think there should be. I'm not sure since that takes place closer to the central part of the distribution rather than the tail, how easy that is to measure experimentally. On the other hand, when you're measuring like the bispectrum, you're definitely measuring things that are closer to the central part of the distribution. So there must be some comparable thing you can do for voids that's useful. I'm not sure observationally exactly what the status of that is.
That's what I was asking.
Yeah. I don't know. I know lots of surveys designed to look for clusters, but I don't know if the surveys are looking for voids.
But the problem is that voids are sort of amazing. They're a nonlinear. They're also a nonlinear phenomenon, because I mean, the relative location of galaxies and clusters is something that develops with as structure correctly. And so what we talked about today, I think, sort of the sort of drain of structure through nonlinear process. And so lambda CDM sort of these computer models, if you have structure every. And so it's sort of like some clusters, so you have all these different scales as well. So it's hard to know, like, you have to come up with a good definition of a void for you to have a void distribution. And I don't care if there's a good definition.
But there is some sense in which your initial voids track towards the day, right? So
yeah, right.
So maybe for the biggest ones, like the biggest clusters, you could.
Right. But you have to estimate their line. I think the locations of those may have nonlinear effects. The locations and properties of this. So you have to have some complicated way of like tracking back what you see today as the year to what kind of a local density region you have and what.
Sounds like you're saying theoretical analysis would be more important. I think so. But I was just asking, is there even an observation on
You can reorganize that same information basically by, by basically integrating over the mass. So instead of separating clusters out by their mass, you can integrate above some limiting mass, which you think your survey is going to see. And then just look at this as a function of redshift. So these are the same type of curves again, showing you again that at high redshift, you know, we don't trust the distribution so much again because we assume very large fluctuations. But in this sort of reasonable range, which I think is reasonable for upcoming cluster surveys, you can potentially see pretty large deviations here. So these are the same set of ones.
Yeah, they are. I'll show you. We did vary a little bit across quality. And there have been some really nice examinations of, for example, how we can determine our communication state, as well as FNL, things like that. So I think all of that is great, but I think it should be redone across with scale depending on this. Yeah, that's our mass limit, which is basically something that the South Pole Telescope says is reasonable. Again, reorganization of that information into, now instead of the total count, just the ratio of the non-Gaussian to the Gaussian. And again, you can see, you know, 20 to 30%. Again, this is the uncertainty limit for the blue line. This is the uncertainty limit for the green line. So as you make yourself more and more non-Gaussian, more and more scale dependent, you trust that distribution to shorter and shorter redshifts. Okay, but there are lots of issues with this, basically, which is that in order to actually measure this, you need to know the cluster mass well. You need to know sigma 8 well, because clusters are very sensitive to sigma 8. Again, this is a couple of analyses that have been done that are useful here. But let me...
It's going to be really important here, right?
Yeah.
Just one thing that was up was that if you include a full graph of cosmological parameters, then that's probably that you're going to have degeneracy.
I think this is the biggest one, sigma 8, and also this. If you look at these papers that do the analysis with, for example, dark energy, there's not too much degeneracy between dark energy and Bitcoin and non-Gaussianity. So that part you probably don't need to worry about as much. These two are big concerns. And that's essentially worst case scenario of what they do. This is adding, same like they showed you before, but adding the case if you mistake your mass limit by 5%, or sigma 8 by 5%. And you can see that this can wash out a lot of that signal. Mm-hmm. Now, the examples I showed you before and some other papers claim that it's, you know, eventually muddy various measurements will know sigma 8 to maybe 2%, and then you can do it a lot better here. And again, the mass limit you expect eventually to know for 2 or 3%, and then you can start getting better. So, these are again the ratio for G and Z. Again, you can see that kappa minus 0.3, the biggest case, sort of maybe can evade that. And if you can cut up things and the ratio of things are past things, you can probably do okay. So, let me show you what sort of a Fisher matrix analysis says. So, these are a couple of cases with the fiducial model chosen when kappa equals to zero everywhere. Either small FNL at CNP scales or large positive, large negative FNL. So the best case scenario that you can do is if you have large FNL, because then basically because you have this k to the kappa dependence, you're pretty sensitive to how that changes. So in the best case scenario, you might hope with Planck priors to be able to measure an FNL of 0.2, something like that. A little bit worst case scenario, FNL of 38, so it's small, so you're not particularly sensitive to that kappa value, and you don't do very well at all. However, this is also, you know, fiducial model of kappa equal to zero. So probably if we go back and take kappa equal to 0.1, that'll be a little more realistic analysis for the case where you have running. The other thing is, this is just clusters. So once you start including, you know, measuring scale dependence in the CMB, measuring scale dependence in the bispectrum, adding cluster data, I think it's maybe not unreasonable
And then at least kappa 0.2 and 0.3 would show up. And already you can do a little better if you divide your clusters up into mass bins. Not much better, but it helps this case quite a bit. 0.08 here with Planck, 0.16, 0.17, and a slight improvement here. So if you could have lots of mass bins, lots of redshift bins, you could maybe do okay. So I think really this analysis needs to be redone in a non-Fisher matrix way. This is my first experience with Fisher matrix, but I feel like something like Monte Carlo probably would give a lot more accurate result here. So I don't know. Okay, what does this actually do to the bispectrum? So I'm going to show you, again, there's sort of a similar translation problem, right, between what you calculate as your primordial bispectrum and what you actually measure in terms of galaxy bispectrum. So without going into too many details of that, basically, again, we have, you know, this three-point function with some k-dependent function out there. The contributions to the bispectrum that we measure are some initial piece, some gravitational piece, some piece that's a combination of the trispectrum, linearly evolved. So basically, in our case, this piece is going to swamp the gravitationally induced piece. So I'll show you what that looks like. But we don't have to worry too much about anything except this, again, because we're assuming that the higher order correlations are suppressed by extra couple orders of magnitude. What's good about this is we can take out some of those dependences on cosmological parameters that crop up inevitably in clusters. So for example, the dependence on sigma 8. And again, people talk about measuring the reduced bispectrum, which gets rid of a lot of that dependence by dividing out by the power spectrum. And then you can see the gravitational piece, pretty small. And depending on the size of FNL, these are all those transfer functions, et cetera. This piece can be much larger. Again, this analysis has been done for a scale-independent case by Sebusati and Komatsu, indicating that the bispectrum is competitive with the CMB for FNO. So the issue is comparing this to clusters. Basically, you need some additional modeling parameters because you need to know how to go from these dark matter halos to your actual clusters. Overall, there's a larger range of scales encompassed just by the bispectrum itself, but it doesn't hit as small of scales as clusters. So some gain, some loss. Less dependence on cosmology. Essentially, it's nearly as sensitive to the CMB, and there are plenty of upcoming surveys that will test this. And there's the deviation based on running of kappa. So basically, the two ways to look at that function I showed you before are to look where all k are equal or to look at some ratio of the k. So in the equilateral limit, which is shown here, there's no difference between the DBI model, local model, whatever. And you can just look at what, again, the limiting values of FNL with some running do. This is the region you're mostly sensitive to. You can see some shape difference, a few percent, not much. If you look at it, choosing some ratio of k's and look at it as a function of the angle in between, again, you can see a different shape between the local model and the DBI model. So you can see the local model in dashes. You can see the equilateral model, right? Local model up here, equilateral model here. So there's quite a difference there. And changing what ratio of scales you take, of course, changes the magnitude of this guy. So I think this again can be handled sort of with a Fisher matrix. If you go through, putting in all the bias parameters, things like that. We haven't done that yet. I think basically just wanting to illustrate what the difference in the shape is. And I think, again, probably you should go through a more like a Monte Carlo analysis of this with all of your dark matter equation of state, things like that added in too. Okay. So the upshot, I think, is first of all that large or running and or running non-Gaussianity is a signature of something interesting. So you don't get it in standard slow roll. You get a little bit of running, but not something that you can observe. If you get something that's really large, like FNL above 1, that's really a signature of some kind of interesting inflationary model. Furthermore, then, if you believe some model like this for some other reason, you believe extra dimensions, you have a really interesting handle on the background of that theory in, for example, the geometry. The scale dependence then is motivated by that, and if it's increasing, of course, you have a better handle on it at small scales. If it's decreasing, which is certainly also possible in other models of DBI or anything like that, so that you would have maybe a large signal at CMB scales and then decreasing on smaller scales, that's also something you could maybe test.
You said it, what does it mean?
Yeah, that's just saying that it's something like DBI, that the way the sound speed changes is correlated with the warp factor of the extra dimensions.
Oh, so, higher dimensional.
Yeah, higher dimensional. Okay. And finally, probably the most useful thing, it looks like we can detect something like a 30% change in the mass function, which, you know, maybe if you have a large non-Gaussian entity and a running of, you know, moderate size, is something you can test. And probably the best way to do even a little bit better than that is to combine a lot of measurements and to reanalyze the CMB itself. So in that direction, basically, there are a lot of data sets of clusters that should be coming in the next few years. And with better modeling to see how well the mass function that we're proposing actually matches something you would get from simulations, then you can compare those data sets with what we're proposing. Definitely, it'd be relatively straightforward to go back and reanalyze the CMB with a scale dependence, and that would be interesting. One way to resolve a lot of these problems that are giving us uncertainties at high masses and high Z, where, you know, in principle, you can get even better results because you have even fewer, more massive clusters, is to do better with simulation, like n-body simulation. So again, that involves understanding better a lot of these issues of the probability distribution, because in order to lay down your initial conditions for n-body, you need to know how to deal with those, with the probability. There are also other interesting constraints that might be just as relevant. One is primordial black holes, because now we're talking about scales that are much, much, much different from CMB scales, you know, orders and orders of magnitude different. So if you could say, well, if I have this runaway non-Gaussian entity, I'm going to overproduce black holes, that already limits you. And that's something we're trying to understand. Just a couple days ago, there was a paper by Dalal and collaborators indicating that it looks like initial non-Gaussian entity actually changes the type of bias, galaxy bias, that you have. And they're claiming that this, just measuring the 2-point, is actually competitive with the CMB for non-Gaussian entity. So if something like that is true, then that gives you yet another handle, and probably even, maybe even a more useful one. Okay, thanks.
So looking further ahead, have you thought about 21 centimeter?
Yeah, that would be fantastic. We haven't, done too much of that, but I think clearly since you have so many more data points,
right,
it's much better. Also, it's just getting you, I think you still have these issues of, I guess if you're doing the bispectral, you don't have so many issues, but for that range of Z, that's probably a much more interesting range to look at.
You mentioned that you can talk about testing strength theory as much. What does that mean? Can you falsify different strength models with this kind of data?
I think one of the most interesting things is to get deflection to work in strength theory.
We've heard about that recently. So, there's this paper by Tate Mark et al.
Yeah.
Explaining that it's hard to get deflation from simpler strength brain fields.
Yeah.
You have to go to more complicated ones. The complicated remains to be seen. So.
That seems to be true. And this sort of DBI is one way that you can evade this issue of getting a flat potential, just because you can still get enough deflation, even though your potential is corrected by all kinds of things that make it seem. So. If you were to see something like a large non-Gaussian entity, first of all, I think that it's coming from some theory that's not easily written as sort of a truncational and effective field theory, just because you need to add lots and lots of terms, or you need to have a sharp feature at some particular scale. So it's really not something you can easily mock up just by writing down kind of a generic flat potential. So you're really sort of testing interactions that are hard to write down if you're writing down generic field theory. Okay, that's a strong statement. But you can go further, of course, in something like a model like DBI. You have all the wonderful things of, cosmic spins with the strength spectrum. You would have non-Gaussian entity correlated with tensor scalar ratio. And if you saw all of those things put together, that's a pretty strong indication that you have some kind of, background geometry that's giving you this bizarre
spectral cross ray is bizarre when you're not guessing.
And you look for something bizarre.
What's that?
If you look, you're looking for something bizarre.
Yeah, bizarre from writing down it.
Yeah, because the problem is it's very hard to use a cosmological notation because to really say if you have the truth.
Yeah. And at least at a minimum, if you don't see non-Gaussianity, this kind of inflation string theory doesn't work. So at a minimum, you have to say that it's wrong, which is not useful.
So, this is a very general question that maybe I'm missing something, but why do you not see all this information already at the CMB? I mean, there's much less nonlinearity there that you have to struggle with. Is it just that the resolution isn't good enough, or is this in principle information this galaxy can expect? Is that information that's even in principle not available from the CMB?
So two reasons. One, basically, the simplest reason is that we're hoping that something that gets a you know, it's consistent with current CMB constraints, so maybe not a super large non-Gaussianity at CMB scales, because it has scale dependence, has a larger effect on smaller scales. So in that sense, the CMB just isn't probing a wide enough range of scales.
So if you had sort of perfectly accurate CMB measurement, you wouldn't need to do this.
Yeah, that could be true. Although you still, you know, it still might be a feature at scales below CMB if it wasn't smooth or something that you wouldn't pick up.
Yeah, you couldn't see non-Gaussianity. Yeah. That was one of the big things in the testing, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. There's no reason you couldn't see it. It depends on how much non-Gaussianity.
So how does this more sensitive than the CMB?
Well, you run high CMB at small scales. You become dominated by secondary effects. You're not looking for more of the power spectrum.
Oh, there's too much.
To get it smaller scale, you gotta do one alpha fluorosphere galaxy.
So, I mean, if you think about it, the CMB is only probing a few defaults of inflation, right? And you're missing all kinds of information about what's happening during the rest of inflation.
Because it's a cutoff.
Yeah. So, if you
I wanted to ask about if I have kappa of 0.3, right? Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that means you're also going to have a pretty decent run-in of the scale for spectral effects, and that those two things are going to be correlated for scale purposes, right?
So they are correlated, but it actually works, at least in BPI, where the larger, as you go to the, basically the large gamma limit, then the spectral index goes to zero. You're going to have a red hole. It goes to exactly one, that's means it goes to zero. So you should have that, you should be able to figure out that value. But again, depending on, you know, what's interesting, what I mean, there's one plot that shows you in solutions of BDI how kappa goes in general. And basically, kappa has it starts near zero and falls off to a larger negative value, and then it should go back to zero. So depending on what scale that fall off happens, you know, you may or may not measure so much of the run in CMB that kappa is roughly constant. You know.
Does that help you or hurt you? I mean, does it introduce a degeneracy that's going to degrade your accuracy on these other things, or does it introduce a correlation that you can use to sort of cross-correlate?
If you were doing this CMB analysis, it would be a great cross-correlation. For clusters, they're not very sensitive to thin as possible.
No, Jim, thanks very much. Over here called Friday.